This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Today, it's our weekly review of the news, and joining us this afternoon to discuss the people, stories, and events affecting the tri-state are Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Shauna Steigerwald, WCPO.com, WCPO Insider Web Editor James Leggett, and later in the show, WVXU reporter Bill Reinhart will join us. You can be part of the conversation at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU.org, or you can join us on Facebook or Twitter. And James and Shauna, good to see you this afternoon.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Very good, in unison. Yeah, you know, let's talk about the one story that's been so dominant this week, Shauna. It's the story that's just gotten so much attention, and that was the Cincinnati Zoo shooting and killing a gorilla named Harambee. And after a 4-year-old boy that was
three-year-old boy.
Okay,
there were some misreports at the beginning. So
he climbed through the barriers and fell into the Gorilla World exhibit. And zoo officials say they had to kill the gorilla to protect the child. And of course, that decision has drawn some criticism and some support. And it's also led to some calling for the boy's parents to face charges. And I should note, in the interest of disclosure, that Zoo Director Thane Maynard has worked with Cincinnati Public Radio for more than 20 years on the program The 92nd Naturalist, and he also conducts interviews for Cincinnati Edition. So, Shauna, let's talk about, where does the story stand at this point?
Well, I think, we have the exhibit is going to be reopening next week on Tuesday, and they did make the decision to go ahead and put some additional barriers in place, which was something that people had been asking about what they would do. So they do have a new fence. It's sort of a piece of wood on the top and the bottom with sort of like a rope type of thing in between, 42 inches high. So I know that's been changed and put in. And so that's one of the things that I think people were really asking about, is were they going to look at that exhibit. So that's one of the changes that just sort of they announced yesterday. So that's one of the new developments.
And then on Monday, we're going to be hearing from Prosecutor Joe Dieters about whether or not they're going to be filing any charges in the case. The police turned over their findings to him yesterday, I believe. So then it's just going to be a matter of waiting to see what he has to say.
Okay, and this is charges against the parents.
Yes.
Is that right? I guess these would be like child endangering charges, or do we know anything about that?
Not really, and you don't want to speculate about what he might be looking at, but that's what people have been saying.
Now, beyond the investigation, looking at whether there should be charges against the boy's family, are there other investigations going on, Shauna, at this point?
Well, I know that the zoo is regulated by it's accredited, by the AZA, the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. So I know they're going to come in and take a look. I reached out to them. The statement that they gave me seemed to, I don't want to speculate, but seem to have a supportive tone towards the zoo. But they did say they're going to come in and investigate that, as well as the USDA, which regulates the zoo because of the fact that they keep regulated animals there. So they will come in and do an inspection, which the zoo is regularly inspected at least once a year, if not more than once a year. They last had their last inspection back in April. They didn't have any citations at that time. So because of this incident, there will be a special inspection coming up. They do it unannounced. So at some point, the USDA will come in and take a look and see if they find any reason to cite them for this incident.
And we have no idea what the time frame on that is going to be.
No, because they do it unannounced. They don't want to let the zoo know when they're coming for the inspection. So
513-419-7100 if you want to join the conversation. So let's talk about how this all started, how this broke. James, you were actually working that day.
Yes.
Tell me what that was like when the story broke.
Well, it just came across over the police scanner. I think probably all the large news organizations in Cincinnati and elsewhere have similar operations for breaking news. We're just listening to the police scanner. And then in this case, I don't know if this was exactly what happened, but what we heard on the scanner was that there was a boy who fell into the gorilla exhibit at the zoo, and the gorilla was hitting the boy's head against the wall. So obviously that's something that everyone's going to jump onto right away. In this case, you send your reporters who are out in the field to the scene. In the office, we were calling the police, and you just sort of start breaking it out right away, getting what you can out on Twitter, then get the post up on the website, share that on Facebook, and then just update it as it goes. This was a kind of tricky story to cover at first because since it was on the zoo property, we weren't really able to get in there, and they had cleared everyone out from the gorilla exhibit before then anyway. So you're just sort of trying to find witnesses, searching social media for anyone who shared a photo or a video, so you have an idea of exactly what happened.
Shauna, what was it like at the Inquirer when this happened?
Yeah, I wasn't working on Saturday. Cameron Knight, one of our breaking news reporters, was there, and he did a great job. He had a similar experience. You know, he'd come in, started his shift, thought it was going to be, you know, it's Memorial Day weekend, didn't expect to have anything too crazy going on, and then this happened. And, you know, he was one of the first reporters on the scene, I believe, and was there at the zoo, and kind of same experience trying to track down who you could get a hold of, who you could talk to, what you could find out. I mean, by the time reporters got there, everything was already over, and they'd cleared the exhibit and everything. So he was, you know, followed that as best he could. I didn't get involved until Sunday, you know, when it became clear that this was going to be a story that we really had to get on and continue to follow. And we've been following it ever since. You know, it's been pretty crazy that the attention that it's attracted from an international audience has been surprising to me. I mean, I expected that people were going to be very interested in this story, but it's been even more than I would have thought.
Yeah, what kind of international coverage has this gotten? Because you've actually been involved in some of this, haven't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, yeah. I was on CNN the other morning. I was on Skyped into Headline News. I called into BBC Radio, called into a New Zealand radio station, which that one was, you know, Sunday night right away. They were one of the first ones I talked to.
And yeah, I was surprised at how quickly, too, the international media were all looking into this and trying to get a local perspective.
Right. And then I think that makes, you know, additional challenges in covering it, too, because, you know, like our editor, the piece our editor wrote, talked a little bit about, you know, the decision to not, that we made the decision in the early stages not to name the mother who was, you know, some of the international outlets, you know, were doing that. And so that was a discussion that had to be had here locally in our newsrooms about what we should do about that, since there were people who were organizations, rather, that were seeing the name on social media and maybe putting it out there at a time that we weren't ready to do that.
And in WCPO's case, James, what was your take on the whole, should we name the parents or not?
We also didn't name the parents. In a case like this, these aren't public citizens, so generally you want to respect their privacy if you can. If they are charged, then obviously we will. But at this point, it just didn't seem pertinent to name them.
Yeah, we had the same discussion. You know, we there was no charges filed. It's not like there was something against them. And, you know, with all of the social media outrage that was happening, I mean, the mother was, there were sort of not quite death threats, but almost death threats. I mean, on social media, you know, people saying that the mother should have been shot instead of the gorilla, and all kinds of, you know, terrible things like that. So I think we had to kind of consider that interest, too, as far as, you know, do we want to help feed that frenzy? And, you know, we had a discussion and we really just didn't want to feed into that.
Were you surprised by the reaction on social media and just how quickly it took off?
Yes, absolutely. You know, I don't think I've ever covered a story that people turned into memes before, and in this case, they have. And just people were really angry about it, looking for someone to blame, and it was unlike anything I've seen before.
And I think that the one thing I've tried to look at it is, I think, you know, yes, people are looking for somebody to blame. You know, it's a beloved species. You know, people talk about, you know, primates are close cousins and things like that. But the thing I try to think about is, okay, well, these people who are rushing to social media and rushing to point fingers and place blame, I think that it's human nature to try to find a way to make sense out of a tragedy or a terrible situation. So I'm not a psychologist, obviously, but to me, it seems like people are trying to figure out, like, okay, so how did this happen? So who can we blame so that this doesn't happen again? You know, I mean, it's not necessarily going to work, but it seems to me that that's what people are doing, is looking at, you know, how did this happen and how can we make sense of it?
Yeah, trying to get a sense of order out of something that just was shocking and tragic. So, yeah, I can see why you would say that. It isn't just a case of people being mean or horrible. This is just a normal human reaction.
Mm-hmm.
513-419-7100 if you would like to join our conversation. How much discussion took place in your newsrooms about how to cover the story and what to publish and how best to report it?
Well, I think at first you're just trying to get all the information you can and then just sort of putting everything out there that you get. As the story has gone on, obviously, we've sort of been looking into different angles and looking into the background, looking at, you know, okay, well, how How does the safety at the Cincinnati Zoo compare to other zoos? What other incidents have been like this before at other zoos or here? You know, just a few months ago, they had that incident where the polar bear sort of got out of its holding area but still wasn't out and about. So, and just, you know, really trying to look at, you know, and to the I forget the name of the dangerous animal response team, I think, mm-hmm. that the zoo has. That
right, yeah.
Was one of their staff who was the one who actually shot Harambe. And just, yeah, I mean, it's been every day since then. We've been trying to look into new angles to cover and dig up more information.
Yes, you know, same in our newsroom. It starts out in the beginning, obviously, just trying to get the facts and the news as quickly as possible. But then, you know, sort of the day two, day three, day four, you know, lots of coordination among different reporters covering different types of angles and, you know, meetings to determine, you know, things like, you know, do we name the mother? At what point do we name the mother? You know, things like what's the right way to sort of cover the social media response, since that was something that was, you know, different. And, you know, and today things are a lot different. You know, you're not just sending a reporter and a photographer out to the press conference. You know, we had about five of us went to the press conference. We had somebody doing Facebook Live. We had somebody doing Snapchat. We had somebody doing video. We had somebody doing photography. You know, I was writing the story. So it's you know, there's a lot of different ways and things that we can use to cover stories now at our disposal that we wouldn't have had, you know, maybe 10 years ago. So it's definitely been interesting. You know, we're experimenting with a lot of new things, and I'm sure you guys are too. So it's definitely been interesting to see all the various ways we could cover the story now too.
James was talking about how you did a look back to see if there had ever been any similar incidents in the zoo's history. There were reports, Shauna, that there were a few citations over the last several years, mm-hmm. against the zoo. Now, what turned out with those?
Well, I went through the database. You can look at them on public records on the USDA's database. And, you know, the most recent one was the polar bear. Mm-hmm. They got the citation for that. But, you know, the other ones were things like, you know, two of them were related to some boards that were maybe not quite in good repair on, you know, one of the exhibits. It wasn't anything where an animal could get out, for example, but it was like, you know, it was harder to keep it clean kind of thing. And there was something about sanitation in a rhinoceros cage, for example. And, you know, these were going back for the last 3 years, which is what the records go back. I think there were about 10 of them. You know, none of them were related to the gorilla exhibit in any way. And their most recent one didn't have – their most recent inspection, rather, didn't have any citations, which was in April. So presumably, you know, the USDA didn't see anything wrong with Gorilla World when they were there.
And everything's fixed
in April.
Good.
Yeah. So –
So, happening on a holiday weekend, how tough was it to get a hold of the sources you needed to talk to develop this story?
Well, in a way, it might have helped. I mean, the zoo might have been a little busier than usual because it was a holiday weekend. There were a lot of people there. And when you're able to talk to more sources, it helps because you can sort of get a sense that what they're telling you is true, because there are some weirdos out there who just want the attention and will say anything to try to get out in the news. So we were able to talk to, you know, a number of different people. And then I think the hardest thing was to find any photo or video, though. I think we all had, I think, the same one photo and one video from when the boy was in the enclosure. And, you know, you would think that there would be more of that.
It was also the thing that was difficult, I think, was trying to get a hold of more experts, you know, like someone from the Association of Zoos and Aquariums or gorilla experts and things like that. You know, various organizations in zoos are a little bit harder to get a hold of on the holiday weekend, it seemed like, too.
Now, there was a child that was mauled to death by wild dogs at the Pittsburgh Zoo December of 2012. Did either of your organizations go back and look at how that incident and make a comparison to what happened here?
I referenced that in the story that I wrote about the USDA, just to kind of try to see, you know, what the response time was. I want to say it was like, I can't remember off the top of my head, I don't think it was like maybe 14 or 15 months later, the zoo did get a fine of about $4,500, you know, in regards to that incident. And I believe they tried to dummy trank those dogs, the wild dogs, from what I've read, and that was not successful. So,
now one of the critics, this has been kind of a surprising reaction to me. The Toledo Blade has been very, very strong in its reaction to what happened at the Cincinnati Zoo. They've called for a boycott of Cincinnati and for the firing of zoo director Thane Maynard over this. Shauna, does this go back to your idea of they're just trying to make sense out of something.
I don't know. Maybe I did read that editorial. You know, I think we were talking about earlier. You know, they mentioned some different things about, you know, they are maintaining that the gorilla was trying to help the child. You know, according to an expert, they didn't cite that expert, so I don't know where they're getting that information. You know, so it's a little hard to say. And they brought the Reds into it too, so I don't know. I don't know how those are connected other than they're both Cincinnati.
Yeah, and some of the – what they were claiming in the editorial went directly against what the zoo director Thane Maynard had said. And you would think that he would be a good expert on that topic. And I think other zoo directors have backed him up in that. So, you know, about the tranquilizer and how that wouldn't have taken effect quickly enough and could have angered Harambe to make the situation even worse.
Now, do you think a story like this shows the difference between traditional news organizations and the newer breed of bloggers, basically anyone who can publish stories quickly? Do you think this shows the difference between the two types of news gathering?
I think it does a little bit. I mean, I think like we were talking about earlier with making decisions like do we name the mother and things like that. I mean, and certainly, you know, speculating and things like that. I mean, those are things that we just, you know, aren't going to do. I mean, we hold ourselves to a very high standard as to what we're going to report on, and we want to make sure that we have the facts correct and that we're not, you know, falling into the trap of, you know, following after these blogs and things like that. So, you know, we obviously, you know, as traditional media outlets, we do want to be leaders in the coverage, but we also want to make sure that we have the facts right and that we're not, you know, causing more harm than good by putting something out there that maybe doesn't have all the right information.
Yeah, and, you know, as more traditional outlets, we're looking at more objective reporting, whereas online, they may not have the same rules and they may just have a completely opinionated piece. I mean, or, I, you know, then there was The Blade, too, which also was
took a pretty blunt position on the
strongly
whole thing.
Worded.
Yeah. Now, something that's been called for out of this is Harambe's law. Can somebody explain to me what Harambe's law is, where this is headed?
Yeah, the basic idea, it started as a petition after Harambe was shot, and the basic idea is that it would bring consequences for someone who's, I think the way that's worded, their negligence would cause the death of an animal like this.
So it would become a crime to contribute by your actions
to the
death of an endangered species, I think it was.
Yeah, correct. Yeah.
Is that an Ohio law? Is that what they're trying to get?
I believe they were sending it to state lawmakers in Ohio, yes.
Yeah, correct. According to our reporting, as of the other day, there were over 100,000 people who'd signed it online. So there was some interest in it, and I think that Ohio lawmakers are still sort of considering that and investigating whether or not that the current laws cover that in any way, or if there needs to be an additional law or not. So I think that was something that people are still, lawmakers rather, are still sort of looking into.
Okay, so no decision on whether Harambe's law becomes law or not. It's just it's something that's in the works.
And with these online petitions, anyone can sign it. So, you know, you don't know how much sway that's going to hold with local lawmakers.
How many signed the online petition?
According to our reporting, as of a couple days ago, we had 106,000 signatures is what we have in our reporting. So,
yeah. Have any local lawmakers said, I'll work on this?
I'm trying to remember what exactly they had said. I think that that they talked to the representative from Green Township, Bill Seitz. I think they'd spoken with him about it, and he kind of said that he was looking into it and whatnot. I don't think he thought that there would be, you know, any jail time or anything for the mother, so I think that he was weighing in on that. So,
and I think his position probably is he'd be one of the folks who probably say there's existing law out there too, I would think, to deal with it. So where does the story go from here? I mean, they're just are we going to be hearing about this for the next month, or what are your thoughts?
Well, I think people are still talking about it. Certainly some people are starting to get a little tired of hearing about it, I think. But it's just got such legs on this story. It upset so many people. And, you know, while we locally, probably most people heard about it right away, since it has gone to be this international story, more people keep learning about it as time goes on.
Yeah, and I think like we talked about earlier, it might depend too on some of the things that happen next week. you know, with the prosecutor's office and whatnot, too. I mean, that may cause some more attention to be drawn to it. I mean, I don't know. It seems like there's not quite as much attention as there was. I don't know.
Yeah.
What do you think? It seems like it's died down a little bit.
Yeah, it's definitely slowing down.
Yeah, but yeah, I think next week will be... could be some additional interest there, too.
Yeah, whatever the prosecutor announces could generate a lot more interest in the story. Have you been getting more international requests, though, Shauna?
No, I haven't.
That's died down, too?
Yeah, so that's why I'm thinking, well, it seems like maybe the world media has maybe moved on a little bit, so.
Have you gotten any complaints from readers that they're tired of the story?
I don't know. I've seen a couple comments on, you know, social media, but... You know, I mean, people are definitely reading the stories, so, you know, we do know that people are reading these stories.
You get comments on stories about just about anything that people are tired
of. That's true. It's true.
As an editor, I'm sure you see a lot of that, James.
That's a good point.
How do we do reporting the story, do you think? Was there any one thing in reporting on this that really concerned you or maybe shocked you?
Certainly shocked by the amount of anger at what people were saying about the parents of the boy. And I'd say just the concern would be to not make that worse.
Yeah, I think the venom, it's unprecedented in my reporting experience, is the venom that we saw on social media, you know, both with, again, the people saying things about the mother, you know, people saying things about the zoo, you know, the venom, I think, was something that I had never experienced before. And it was definitely a surprise for me.
Mm-hmm. Did you happen to keep count of how many views certain things got, James?
Not in the past few days, but it's definitely one of our most popular stories of the year.
Yeah, I think we had one Facebook post that got like 8,500 views about Harambe. So,
I know. I think our coverage was like in the millions. You know, as far as over the weekend and you know some of those initial stories. So it's definitely. People are definitely wanted to know more about it.
Well, yeah, and it is an important story. I mean, and the news media, of course, will continue to follow up on this until and when the reports are released and we get through all that. So we will continue our conversation and our review of news from around the tri-state area. And you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and joining us this week to discuss the people, stories, and events affecting the tri-state are Cincinnati Enquirer reporter Shauna Steigerwald, WCPO.com, WCPO Insider web editor James Leggett, and WVXU reporter Bill Reinhardt. And you can be part of the conversation at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU.org. Or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Shauna, layoffs at Music Hall. I understand that we've got some of those coming as Music Hall shuts down for renovation.
Yeah, correct. It sounds like, you know, as part of the renovation coming up, it sounds like the employees were notified about 6 months ago, according to our reporting. So it sounds like it's something that they knew was going to be coming, but 8 of the 15 full-time staffers and 46 part-time employees are being laid off.
Is this more than what they had initially expected? I mean, I know they were talking about they were going to have some people laid off during the shutdown.
You know, I know that that they had said some were expected. I am not quite familiar with what they had said initially.
Will these folks get their jobs back once Music Hall reopens?
It sounds like they're going to be invited to reapply for those jobs back when it reopens, in the fall of 2017. So they will have a chance to reapply for those positions. And it sounds like some of the ushers from Music Hall may work at the Symphony at the Taft during the upcoming season as well. So that may be an outlet for some of those folks to find some work.
And these are all different positions, I take it, or they're...
Yeah, it sounds like there were some administrative positions that were eliminated, you know, as far, you know, people who oversaw the daily operations and whatnot. And then, you know, some of the part-time people who did sort of security and custodial jobs and concessions and things like that, you know, that won't be needed while the Music Hall is closed.
Mm-hmm. Now, something else, you typically cover entertainment news for
Correct.
The Enquirer.
Yeah, features and entertainment, yeah.
Bunbury's been something that you've been covering, and that starts this weekend.
Correct. It's actually just started right about now. It's getting underway down at Sawyer Point in Yatemans Cove.
Runs the whole weekend?
Correct.
Uh-huh. How many people does that usually draw?
Well, that's the thing that's interesting is that last year there was a problem with lines and whatnot just because it has started to draw so many more people. You know,
they're getting like 20,000 people or something like that
per day.
Per day.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Now last year they had said that, you know, in prior years they had maybe 24,000 people throughout the whole weekend. So over the 3 days. And then last year they had 20,000 people show up on Friday. And so the infrastructure just wasn't there to support that. And so there were a lot of issues with lines and whatnot. Last year there were about 56,000 people altogether. I think they're expecting 50,000 or maybe a little bit more this year as well over the 3 days.
So what's been the what are they doing new this year to help cope with that?
Well, they've come up with they've implemented a wristband system that is used at a lot of the larger music festivals. So it's a pretty high-tech thing, I guess, and it doesn't rely on internet service, which if you've ever been to any of the crowded events downtown, you know that that's important because, you know, if you're down at Bunbury or even if you're at Taste of Cincinnati opening day, things like that, it's really hard to get internet service. So these wristbands basically are your ticket for entry to get in, but they also are a cash system so that you can buy food and drinks and things like that. You load money onto it and you go in and you can use it the whole weekend. So it sounds like it's been used at Coachella and Lollapalooza and some of the bigger music festivals around the country. So it'll be interesting to see if that sort of alleviates some of the problems from last year.
RFID technology, I think, is what they're using.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We'll see how it works. And this is all designed to try to cut down the lines and cut down the waits.
Right. Yeah. So that sounded like last year they had, you know, again, last year they had such an influx of people coming in that they just couldn't quite handle the volume.
Bill, we were talking earlier about the social media response to the story about Harambe. Now, you did a story on bike trails that apparently got a lot of response.
Not quite.
Not quite as much as Harambe.
Yeah,
but just
a hair under that. Last week, there was a proposal before Hamilton County Commissioners. Cincinnati Connects, which is heavily involved in bicycling and cycling trails around Hamilton County, asked for $360,000 for three separate projects. Not huge projects. There was the Duck Creek Connector. There was the Duck Creek would connect Wasson Way, Oasis, and Armletter Trails. And then there was a couple of projects along the Mill Creek. Now, they had a deadline of May 31st to apply for the grants from OKI. The money was coming from the federal government, transportation grants. The commission said, well, you know, we really don't know if we have the money for this. Come back next week and we'll see if we can see what we can do. So they came back on Tuesday, May 31st, with that deadline.
And they said, we don't have the money.
And they said, we don't have the money. But Commissioner Todd Portune said, well, here's another option. How about instead of $360,000, we give them $320,000 and drop one of those projects? And the commissioner said, yeah, we still don't have the money. And Portune came back and said, well, look, we don't need to give them the money right now. We just need to pledge to give them the money in the future. We don't have to pay it right now. In fact, the soonest we would have to pay it out would be 2018, and we can probably come up with the money by then. The other two commissioners, Dieters and Monzel, were not swayed by that, and the motion died for a lack of a second.
So what happens with these projects?
Nothing.
Nothing.
Nothing just
okay.
yet anyway. They, you know, they'll be able to come back and apply probably next year for these grants, as I understand. But in the meantime, these connecting trails will just be as is. You, if you want to go from trail to trail, you'll just be out on the streets. So
in the meantime, and it was Todd Portune, I think, who was pushing.
Yes.
Okay. So, but nothing there. So, fair to say, it was a 2-1 vote. Is that what it?
It didn't even come up for a vote.
Didn't even. Okay. Nobody would even push it that far.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, it's surprising as Cincinnati is such a biking town. I'm really surprised that the idea that they couldn't get that advanced.
Well, the big question from Monzel and from Dieters was basically, you know, we don't have the money. We like this idea. We like the idea of what bicycle trails can do for a community, transformative, but we just don't have the money. And there's a lot of other things we do need to spend money on. There was discussion about dipping into the emergency reserves, and Monzel and Dieters did not like that because they pointed out, well, we're already dipping in to fund the 911 communications center, and if we're going to be using the emergency funds, it should be for something that's an emergency or public safety related.
James, UC's got a new police chief and a new assistant police chief. Who are they?
Yeah, just announced yesterday. The new chief is Anthony Carter. He comes to UC from the Federal Reserve Bank, where he's been the chief law enforcement officer there. And before that, he was with Cincinnati Police for about 23 years. The new assistant chief is Maris Harold. She was also with Cincinnati Police, I guess, for about 23 years, too. And this comes after the resignation of the former chief and the major, who sort of resigned amidst this whole departmental overview.
Yeah, and that departmental review revolves around the shooting of Sam DeBose. Is that right?
Yeah, it all started back then in the summer when former UC officer Ray Tensing was charged for murder in the shooting death of DeBose. And UC said that they wanted to just be proactive with their reform. They wanted to go in, change the department. So this report came out, I think it was in April, that said the former chief had been leading up this whole effort to push for the off-campus traffic stops around UC that were of the same kind that Tensing stopped DeBose for. So this is just kind of the next step in that. They both, Carter and Harold, said that they want to bring more changes to the department. They weren't totally specific about what that would be, but they said they wanted to be more inclusive. They said they wanted to work with the community, and they won't always get along, but we'll try to find common ground.
Now, and we should be clear that these changes are just part of several administrative changes they've made for UC Public Safety and the police department there, right?
Yeah, they brought on a new public safety director, a new I forget all the positions off the top of my head, but they brought on basically a whole new team to lead public safety and try to improve their relations with the community.
Again, 513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. Shauna, can I ask what your thoughts are on the administrative changes at UC Police?
Well, I haven't been involved with that story, but, you know, I've certainly been following it. You know, obviously there's a lot of interest in that story, too, you know, with some of the background there. So, I mean, I think it'll be interesting to see. You know, James, do you know a little bit about the background of these new personnel?
Like I said, they had both been at Cincinnati Police for about 23 years each, and then Anthony Carter had also gone to the Federal Reserve Bank branches for Cincinnati and Cleveland, lifelong Cincinnati resident. They mentioned yesterday they were both Xavier graduates, though.
But, okay. Good school. That's where I went. Maybe I'm biased.
And you know, the other thing, the Cincinnati budget, that continues to make news this week. We have some of council that's mm-hmm. is pushing for audits before the budget vote. Bill, what are they pushing for? Why are they pushing for
audits of the Metropolitan Sewer District and the Parks Department? Both agencies have come under fire for unfettered spending, shall we call it.
Unfettered spending.
Unfettered, yes.
Okay.
Spending without a whole lot of oversight. And so the city has said, well, we're going to audit you. We're going to look through how you've spent everything, and we're going to have someone who's kind of independent do this. Now, that's Bill Moeller, former assistant city manager and former finance director, if I'm correct. And he's going through the audit. Some on council are not happy with the speed of how that audit's going. They say, we need these audits now before we vote on budgets, and we need to know what's going on. And a couple of members of council are not too happy because they've not seen the audits yet. And there's also questions of, are these audits truly independent? The mayor says they are. The city manager says, yes, they are. Bill Mueller's doing his thing. We're not interfering with him at all. And the process will be done when it's done, and it'll be done thoroughly. I believe it was Kevin Flynn who says, yeah, let's take our time and get it right and do it right. Don't rush it, and we'll vote on it when we get them.
No, they're coming up against a deadline, though, aren't they?
End of the month, I believe, they have to have their budget finalized. Just last night, they had the first budget hearing. Our Jay Hanselman was there, and he said there were quite a few people. Sometimes these budget hearings, these public hearings on the budget don't attract a lot of people. Sometimes there's more council members there than there are citizens, but last night I guess it was a packed house.
Okay. So is there any concern that they will miss the deadline?
I don't know that that's a worry. I think it's just some council members want to go through the audits with a fine-tooth comb, and they want enough time to do it, not just, here it is, now let's vote.
Meantime, you have the Cincinnati FOP, who is asking the city for the 50 new cars that have come in. I think it's 50-some-odd cars, Shauna. And the FOP is saying, where are our cars?
So, yeah, it's funny. It was just yesterday morning. I was out on a walk, and one of the Crown Vics, you know, the standard police car, went by, and I thought, aren't they supposed to get new patrol cars one of these days? And lo and behold, within a couple hours, there's the story in the Inquirer.
Yeah. So what's going on here, Sean?
Well, it sounds like the police union is saying, hey, we want the cars now, you know, and accusing the city manager of holding them for a press conference, whereas the city manager is saying that, you know, the cars need to be outfitted with, you know, computer technology and decals and all the things that you need to put in a police car. So it sounds like there's definitely some back and forth going on there as far as who thinks what.
So he's saying, it's not for my press conference. It's just it takes time to get these cars out on the street.
Yeah, correct. That's what he's saying. So yeah, you know, decals, logos, computers, lights, license plate readers. There's a whole lot of things that have to be implemented.
Smoke screen, oil, for high speed chase.
No, it's not the James Bond car.
Oh, sorry,
Bill. It's not the James
Bond signal.
Bat signal.
Well, and you also have at the same time that the police union is discussing raises with the city of Cincinnati. So I think they were asking for raises over the next few years, and yeah, that's all revolving around the FOP contract, which expired at the end of May, and that they're still negotiating on. I think they have their next negotiating session on June the 6th. We will continue our conversation, our review of the news from around the tri-state area, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining us this week as we talk about the people, the stories, and events affecting the tri-state area, Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Shauna Steigerwald, WCPO.com, WCPO Insider Editor James Leggett, and also WVXU reporter Bill Reinhardt. And you can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU.org. Or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And let's go back for a minute to Harambe's Law. We were talking about that earlier, which, James, again, what would Harambe's Law do?
Basically make it a crime to cause the death of an endangered animal.
Okay. So one of our listeners looked it up online. She actually went online to sign the petition. And she says it's now up to 188,000 people that have signed it. So are you surprised by that reaction, that it's got that many?
You know, considering the outpouring that we've heard from the world community.
I actually thought it might be more at this point.
Yeah. it's not surprising that people are continuing to go on and, you know, I guess signing the petition is a way that some people maybe are sort of expressing their opinion or feeling on the situation, too. So,
any thoughts, Bill?
No.
No? Okay. No. you want to talk about the Ferris wheel.
Yeah.
What in the world? A Ferris wheel? It's going to be on Newport,
there's a developer that wants to build a Ferris wheel. I mean, if you've ever seen the London Eye, it's kind of – that was one of the first in the world, I believe, a big scenic Ferris wheel.
Sits on their riverfront.
Yeah, sits on the Thames. You get into a big glass container, and it takes you a couple hundred feet up in the air. There's a proposal to do the same.
Okay, you just lost me. I'm not going 100 feet up in the air.
Well,
no, I'm scared of heights.
It's pretty. Oh. The London Eye has got a great view, and I can imagine one on the levee would have a beautiful view as well. I don't know a lot of the details on it. I believe they are getting some assistance or will apply for assistance from the state, but I don't know how it's going to be paid for or exactly how much it's going to cost.
It's going to be $10 million was the cost that we had reported on it. And yeah, they're expecting it to draw about 500,000 people per year to ride it.
That many?
Yeah, that's what the developer is estimating. So, you know, It's not clear if it will or not, but that was the estimate that they had put out there. So,
and they've said that they had a couple others that are turning a profit too in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina,
right.
And another in Florida, which I believe that the price is supposed to be close to the Myrtle Beach one, which is $14 to ride for an adult, $9 for a child.
But you're up there for a while in these things.
I think it's like 10 to 12 minutes or something, wasn't it? Something like that.
I was on the London Eye, 2003, and I think the whole trip was 45 minutes. So it was you're up there for a good long time.
And to James' point, if I understand right, this one will look more like the one that's in Myrtle Beach.
So, correct. Yeah, I think it's the same developer.
Yeah.
So
okay.
It's supposed to be have LED lighting at night. It's supposed to give panoramic views over the river.
And one of the gondolas is a VIP gondola.
Ooh.
Don't know what that means.
It means it costs more than $14. Yeah. So I've heard 235 feet. Is that right,
right.
Shana?
Mm-hmm. Correct. Yeah. So it's definitely I think I'm kind of with you on the heights thing. That sounds like it could be scary. But I my understanding is that they're going to be enclosed. So it's not like you're, you know, the old Ferris wheels, you know, I can remember from a kid where your feet are dangling.
Yeah.
Those are the ones that I would want to avoid. So it sounds like it's going to have the enclosure there. So that'll be a little bit different. And I think that it's part of sort of ongoing efforts at the Newport-on-the-Levee. I know they've been trying to do a lot of redevelopment down there. And, you know, they're trying to compete now with the banks and things like that. So, you know, trying to get some more attractions to draw more folks down to the levee.
They've had a number of bold ideas around the levee just in the last 10 years. There was a proposal to build a hotel on top of the Purple People Bridge.
Right.
And I don't think that really went anywhere. And there was the Purple People Bridge climb, and that operated for, a year or two? And I don't know that ever really took off because, people with heights issues, perhaps.
Well, and if they stick a Ferris wheel in there, Bill, it's certainly for more than a couple of years. It sounds like that's a long-term project.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And you said $10 million for this project.
$10 million is what the developer is estimating right now as far as the project goes. And it sounds like they've got the support of the city of Newport backing them. And, you know, it sounds like the folks down at the Newport and the Levee are excited about it. Like I said, I think they're really working to try to look to attract more different types of entertainment and you know, even restaurants and different things down to the levee because, you know, there's a lot more down in the region, in the banks and whatnot, than there was when Newport-on-the-Levee was first built. So I think that this is one of the ways that they are looking to attract more people to the levee.
Bill was saying it's going to be a long ride. Do you know how long?
According to our reporting, it's about 10 to 12 minutes. So it's a decent amount of time that you're up there, and it's 21 stories above the river. So.
Okay. I mean, as much as I like the idea of this coming, you probably will not find me riding that.
Yeah, 30 gondolas, so, and handicapped accessible, so it sounds like, you know, there's going to be able to get pretty many people on there as well. Each gondola, I think, can get 6 people on there, so you can have pretty many people riding it at once.
I'm sure it'll look nice from the ground, too.
Yeah. So, Bill, why a Ferris wheel? Why not a roller coaster? That's what I want to know.
I don't know. Well, a roller coaster takes up a lot more space.
Well, that's probably a lot more expensive to build a roller coaster than it is a Ferris wheel.
And if you're going to build a roller coaster, well, then you've got to have the merry-go-round and the Dodge'em cars and the octopus. And
the Ferris wheel has that, you know, opportunity to give the panoramic views, too, you know, the opportunity to look over.
Yeah, yeah.
When you're on a roller coaster, you don't have a whole lot of time to...
Yeah, I think there's something nostalgic about Ferris wheels, too, though. I think there's a kind of
a little more
attraction.
Back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, now that I think about it... There was also talk about they're always talking about covering over Fort Washington Way. It was built so you could build a deck. You could build a deck over it, and there's been talk for years about what you would put there. A lot of people just said, you know, extend the banks, make it more mixed development there. And there was talk a couple of years ago about covering the Fort Washington Way and building a Ferris wheel there, something like the London Eye.
So when's this coming?
Next summer.
Yeah, summer 2017. So.
Wow, they're going to build. That's a pretty quick build. So.
Well, I guess they've built a couple. Maybe they know what they're doing.
Yeah.
Hopefully they'll be able to. I mean, you know, construction is always a difficult challenge. You know, so much around weather and things like that. So, I think they're hoping for next summer. We'll see how it goes.
So we've got a few minutes left here. James, what are some of the other stories that you're covering at WCPO.com, some of the other things that you have your eyes on?
Let's see. Well, just yesterday, we were our education reporter, Bob Driehaus, was writing about this school levy that's coming up. They're looking for $48 million a year for the next 5 years, and they say that part of that is going to help I don't know if it's universal or near universal preschool for 3- and 4-year-olds.
And I think we had Bob in last week talking about that, and I think Bob's opinion on it was that this could be a tough sell. This could be a tough sell with the size of the levy.
It's a lot of money, and I think for the average homeowner of – I think on a $100,000 home, it would be an extra $300 a year in taxes.
Shauna, what about you? What are some of the things you're going to continue to keep your eyes on? I guess the Harambe story is still going to be big for you.
Yeah, I don't think that we're going to keep our – we're definitely not going to take our eyes off of that. You know, we're certainly going to keep following those developments. Obviously at the Enquirer, we have people, you know, on a variety of different topics and, you know, everything from City Hall to features and entertainment like I cover. So there's always a lot going on, which is one of, I think, the great things about being in this business is there's always a lot of news and interesting things happening.
And, of course, both your organizations, your continuing coverage at CPO, I think you have a series going on about the heroin crisis. I'm sure that's going to continue.
Oh, yeah, huge problem here. And, of course, we're taking a deep look into that.
And poverty as well, too.
Yes.
I think Lucy Mays is doing some
work. She's been doing a lot of great reporting on, this is, I believe we have the fifth highest child poverty rate in the country in Cincinnati. So it's definitely a big problem.
Those are issues. We have a reporter named Terry DeMio who's devoted to heroin. It's pretty much her full-time beat as well. And we also have a reporter who's been covering sort of the poverty crisis as well. Those are key topics, I think, here in Cincinnati that we all want to keep our eyes on.
Mm-hmm. Bill Lowe, what are you covering? What's on your radar?
Well, I'm not going to tip my hand, but
in front of your competitors?
I've been working on a story for the last month and finally got the main interview today, so I'm just enthused about that. Hopefully by Tuesday morning I'll have the story, but tune in then.
I can't pry it out of you.
Nope. Give you a hint. It deals with alcohol.
Okay. It deals with alcohol. Okay. I can't guess at this point, so I guess I'll just have to wait. So again, the big story that we'll all be focused on, I'm sure, especially with Monday coming up, what's going on with the Cincinnati Zoo, the death of Harambe, and whether the parents will face any charges in that situation.
Yeah, and then they'll be reopening the exhibit on Tuesday.
Yeah. Right. And again, as you were saying earlier, Shauna, that exhibit's got some changes coming, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It has a new barrier. I think they said it's 42 inches high, wood on the top and bottom with, you know, sort of a rope netting thing in there, you know, sort of creating an additional barrier between humans and animals. You know, like I said, they said that they really did some thinking, you know, as far as what they needed to do and when to try to make sure nothing like this could happen again.
Yeah, I'm sure the zoo's going to face more changes as things progress in this investigation of what happened. So thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Cincinnati Enquirer reporter Shauna Steigerwald, WCPO.com, WCPO Insider web editor James Leggett, and WVXU reporter Bill Reinhardt.